Chapter 2. What do you do with a drunken sailor? From the Singing Chaplain's Repertoire.
As you accompany me to my patients, you may find yourself throwing various assumptions overboard. Such as, when I sing to them, you might think I only sing sweet and religious songs, like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, or Kumbaya, My Lord, or something based on the Psalms, such as May the Words of My Mouth. Sam, 28 years old and formerly a policeman, was one of the youngest residents in a nursing home relatively near my office. He was there on account of a disease that was stealthily stealing his motor abilities. Almost every time I stopped in, he gave me a broad, delighted smile. But he decidedly did not want to hear a girly thing like a hymn, though his mother did. She visited him at the nursing home practically every day, to patiently feed him lunch served along with her cheery and loving talk. I often saw her during my weekly visits, and because she found my hymns soothing, I sang them for her benefit when she was around. She kept requesting them every time our visits coincided. Although she had a thing or two to say to God, due to the disease that was destroying her son. Sam, as I implied before, was not ambivalent about religion. He simply was not on board with it. So I tried to think of something non-religious to sing. I had recently found out that one of the things Sam missed a lot at the nursing home was beer. Since I could not quickly arrange to have it made available, this would have required a doctor's order, I thought a song about such beverages might raise his spirits, at least in part. So I energetically sang, "What do you do with a drunken sailor?" 99 bottles of beer, and in heaven there is no beer. All of these elicited his distinctive lingering smile. On subsequent visits, when I asked if he wanted to hear these again, he formed an even longer-lasting smile and said, "Sure." Even his mom allowed herself a grin. At later visits, when he could no longer indicate what he wanted to hear, his smile acted as confirmation. One of Sam's dying wishes was to get a tattoo showing his police rank and years of service. Given his condition, the procedure would have been painful. But his response was, in his soft, high-pitched voice, "I'm tough." Unfortunately, this was complicated to arrange. For one thing, he was not strong enough to leave the nursing home to appear at the tattoo parlor. There was some talk of getting a tattoo artist to make a house call, but by then, Sam was too weak to endure getting the tattoo. Soon after his disease had progressed to that stage, my husband Steve and I saw a performance of Hawaiian hula dancers, and I noticed they had tattoos. Not the kind we typically think of with pictures of hearts and arrows and letters, but of geometric shapes. One of the Hawaiian performers explained that their tattoos signify such matters as family connections and position in the social hierarchy. The higher the rank, the more elaborate and more numerous the designs. I thought of Sam, who wanted us to read his epitaph on his skin, proclaiming who he was and what he had achieved. As he got weaker, more and more family members dropped by to offer their physical presence, if nothing else, and to be there for each other. By then, Sam was virtually nonverbal. At one of my last visits, a friend around his age and his dad, Tim, were there, trying to coax him into nibbling at a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. They did not get very far in promoting the idea. I asked Tim how Halloween had gone the week before, just to find an excuse to stay for a little while and share a few moments with the other visitors. Tim was glad to have something to do like chit-chat with me, besides stare at Sam lying there so listlessly and quietly. He launched into great detail of how he and his fiancée celebrated the holiday. Another layer of sadness in this story is that Sam's mom and Tim were divorced. They even made an elaborate schedule to make sure they did not visit Sam at the same time. He took out his smartphone and showed me various pictures of how they had decorated the house with the requisite bats and spiders, and of their outdoor display of goblins and their spooky peers. But the real horror was Sam, sprawled out on the bed like a forgotten doll, ghastly, with his eyes wide open and unblinking. We were caught in the eerie moment of his being present to us less and less, and the family and I deepening our connections with each other more and more. Before he died, I saw him one more time, and we were alone. As I held his hand, I felt the impulse to thank him for years of service as a police officer, and I like to think that what I said registered in his consciousness because he squeezed my hand at one point. But I will never know for sure. There was one more task to do, a journal for visitors lay open on the bureau. Next to the messages left for each other by home health aides and by each parent to the other, such as, "Sam slept peacefully after I bathed him," I left a message telling his mother and father my final words to their son, hoping that would be of some comfort. I thought about the fact that each parent was not in the company of the other each time the entries in this journal were read. And after Sam's death, would it be discarded as too painful a reminder and meet its own premature end? Or would it be saved and cherished by one of them as a record of their last ties to their son? And if so, by whom? In hospice work, connections usually must be made quickly, as there is often not much time to play with. You literally do not know if a visit will turn out to be the last, even if the patient does want you to return. And so, social preliminaries get telescoped or omitted altogether. Once made, connections can deepen so rapidly, it is like speeding up a film and jumping months ahead. In minutes of meeting a family member, he can be telling me concerns that only his closest friends had been privy to. Or I could be the only person on earth he has ever unveiled those concerns to. The situation itself is rife with intensity, but the mere presence of a chaplain causes tension to build. My being there, not even to pray but simply to listen, is often all it takes for most patients to unleash a prolonged rainfall of words. Once the downpour begins, there is no joining it with even a sprinkle of words of my own, a truth confirmed the times I have been foolish or anxious enough to try and do so. Then, after I hear a person out, singing is one skill at my disposal that contributes to the creation and maintenance of comfort and trust and mutual pleasure. The songs not only do not have to be religious, they can be downright irreverent, as was evident in the example with Sam. Another family where non-traditional song fit best was with the Whitfields. Originally, I met them as I made my rounds of new patients in the skilled nursing home section of a senior care center. I saw them about once a month for almost a year. Mrs. Whitfield, the one on hospice, shared the same room with her husband, but they each slept in separate beds like roommates. One of the nicer rooms in the nursing wing, there was a couch to the left of the door and plenty of space for a stately mahogany bureau topped off with model airplanes and a picture of Mr. Whitfield in a pilot's uniform. Both had served as pilots in World War II. He lived there not only to be with her, but because he needed care himself for severe short-term memory problems. Every time I came in, I had to go through the same ritual of Mr. Whitfield's questions, because on some level I was a brand new face. Where do you live? What religion are you? Where does your husband serve? Often he was mentally located in the past around World War II, and he would ask if I was a pilot too. I would always roll my eyes at that and say being a passenger was more than enough for me when it came to flying. He always gave a hearty laugh at that, and when I said I was a chaplain, he must have thought I meant a military chaplain. I think it puzzled him when I said my husband was a civilian, and there I was, a chaplain with a peculiar gender. He always informed me that both he and his wife were pilots, and that she was a WAC. So naturally I sang out, "The WACs and the waves are winning the war, parlez-vous." And they rewarded me with amused laughter. Even though the repetition of all this at each visit was annoying, I tried to think of it as a ritual worth going through that let me bask in their delight with the sheer pleasure of connecting with another friendly soul. To see what concerns they might have, I needed to move the conversation forward each time I visited in order not to be in a time loop like the weatherman Phil Connors played by Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. So I had to slip in comments and questions that pushed the conversation into new channels. One time I interrupted with, "How long does it take to fuel a plane?" I think he said about 4 hours, depending on the kind of plane. This deepened our connection a bit, as he liked the fact that I was interested in his career. This deepening became far more important and a far greater challenge when his wife truly started going downhill in a big way. They were very close, and he was reluctant to step out of their room when she was feeling too sick to come along. His routine had been to walk behind while pushing her along in the wheelchair. It was a wonder in this limited environment to see their love thrive, as plants and animals do in the most unlikely and inhospitable places such as deserts and in the sunless depths of the ocean. I was apprehensive about his memory loss, though, wondering how I could ever help him anticipate the great loss looming ahead, as he learned of his wife's condition again and again. How would I ever help him start to grieve? And how would he be able to bear it? I decided on my next visit to do two things: to enter the room and talk in a serious and somewhat sad tone from start to finish. I said how sorry I was that Mrs. Whitfield felt so sick. I asked about how they had met and so on, and how he felt at that moment. By then, my efforts were unnecessary. He seemed to have found his own way of coping, which was to exist emotionally even further back in time, even further from the menacing present. He talked with me about applying to be in the Army and his work with RCA. He even offered to help me get a job there. It was defunct in the 1980s. As usual, he was very jolly, ensconced in the good old days. Then a strange thing happened a week or two later. Mrs. Whitfield seemed to be getting better, not worse, and finally the hospice team evaluated her as doing well enough to come off of hospice. She indeed came off, but sadly, after being on hospice for months upon months, she practically died overnight. I'm not sure how much Mr. Whitfield understood about that. When I saw him shortly after her death, he seemed to think she was away at the hospital. When I saw him on subsequent visits, he did not refer to her at all, or respond when I brought up the subject. Perhaps he had found some sort of refuge in one of his replays of earlier days, or was caught in the relatively recent episode when he thought she was only temporarily away, recuperating in a hospital. I hope whatever Groundhog Day he is stuck in will continue to be one of the pleasanter days of his life. Maybe when the waxen waves were winning the war. I do not go out of the way to introduce avant-garde modes of singing, so most of the time my selections consist of hymns or chants, or for the non-religious, American folk and patriotic tunes such as Pete Seeger's If I Had a Hammer, and Samuel Francis Smith's My Country, 'Tis of Thee. This is where the heartwarming anecdotes pour in. One smartly dressed patient in his late 80s, relaxing in his living room with a self-effacing demeanor, remarked, "I've never been sung to before." He did not know quite what to expect from a chaplain, but I wager that a solo singing performance was not among his guesses. I said, "I guess in the old days only royalty could get their own personal concert. Now more of us can." After I finished singing Home on the Range, this modest gentleman and I sat there and chatted about this or that trifle, which temporarily whisked him away from illness and anxiety. I call such a result of small talk or singing a respite visit, meaning relief from what loomed ahead, as I just described. You can live in the moment, no matter how close that moment is to the very last one. Another lovely thing that happens every so often with music is when patients whom I see join in on their favorite hymns, singing or simply mouthing the words along with me, even when it takes them considerable effort. Or family members will sing along, harmonizing with me, forming an instant if transient choral backdrop. This happened when I made a visit to an extremely devout Catholic family, taking care of Mary in her apartment complex off a short side street. She was close to turning 100 and was very lucid. She lay in a hospital bed alongside the living room bay windows, while her two daughters and I gathered round to pray with her. Mary's home was swamped with ornate crosses, pictures of the Pope, and other religious figures, as well as Christmas decorations that everyone wanted to postpone removing as long after Christmas as possible. The decorations echoed the hopeful and appreciative attitude of the family and the numerous visitors coming and going. After praying, I suggested various hymns I could sing, and Mary felt like I was transporting her to church, which she missed dearly. With the two daughters spontaneously joining in and adding a few more verses that I either did not know or felt were too Christian for me to sing, the singing reinforced the sacred atmosphere. As they harmonized with me, we created a miniature choir. "If you cannot go to church, then we'll bring the church to you," I said. Her hope was to live through the 12 days of Christmas and join her Savior shortly thereafter. She did indeed die about a month into the new year. One other touching musical event I recall is my visits to the Jewish Orthodox patient Jacob and his buoyant Slavic health aide Vera, who lived in Monroe Township. Jacob used to go to services, so from my first visit on, I sat beside him and chanted and sang some of the basic prayers of the service for him. With the separation of men and women for prayer no longer operational, for some patients as they age, the outward signs of religion become irrelevant, leaving the core essences, such as expressing love and reverence toward God through prayer. He liked hearing the prayers and joining in very much, and after Vera rushed to clamp a yarmulke on Jacob's head, she produced her iPhone and videotaped my on-screen cantorial debut. The upshot of my media appearance is that at my next visit, Vera told me that Jacob watched the video of my little service every day I was not there, enabling him to pray daily as he used to do. Not only that, Vera reported that Jacob's son was pleased with the prayer on demand video too. When I make my rounds, sometimes the point is not for me to sing at all when I come on the scene, but to elicit it from others and draw out their own creative sparks. On my way into a facility to make some visits, I noticed a resident standing expectantly near the nursing station, his radar out for a potential audience. I know the feeling of hoping for an audience for my own creative outlets, so I obliged, even though he was not one of my patients. I think, too, that particular day I was longing to interact with someone who could be more communicative, as most of the nursing home patients under my care had so few means left for connecting with me, and the nursing staff were often too busy or too jaded by their work to stop and chat. This resident, ignored by everyone else in the vicinity, was humming and humming, so I asked him what the melody was. He told me it was his own song. Then he removed his bowler hat and displayed his original large print lyrics lodged in the rim, protected by a band of trusty plastic. I asked for a performance, and he did not need any coaxing to do so. It was a corny but lilting rhyming song about a woman who always won in alimony cases. More likely than not, he had drawn on ample personal experience for his theme. During future visits to this particular facility, I do not know what became of him, as I never saw him hovering near the nursing station again. Singing, whether done by me or someone else, almost always brings comfort, warmth, relaxation, and respite from thinking about heavy issues, or even renewed energy. But I can remember one time where offering song turned out to be a very bad idea. When I see patients who are nonverbal, I try to communicate by singing to see if they might respond by opening their eyes, smiling, and so on. If I see any signs that they would rather have quiet, such by turning their head away or firmly closing their eyes, I of course stop. I have so little to go on when no one is around who knows their past that when my intuition fails, I simply try gently singing in a low pitch to see if it is welcome. One time, as I was softly singing a hymn to a nonverbal bedbound patient wearing a highly visible cross around her neck, she slowly started to rise into a rigid sitting position, staring wide-eyed directly ahead, her cross sliding off center. Maybe she thought she had heard the angel singing and that God was coming for her. I stopped, and she soon lay back down, her cross once again centered at peace on her chest. Woo! In that case, holding her hand might have been the better option. But I didn't want to risk giving her any more unintended signals. I murmured some pleasant words and beat my retreat. That was my first and last visit with her. Maybe she knew she was in her final days, and even final hours after all, and was telling me, her chaplain, a lot more than I thought I was inadvertently telling her. Music from other sources than personal singing does not necessarily guarantee spiritual or any other kind of well-being either. In an effort to perk up the acoustically and otherwise barren atmosphere of nursing homes, the staff will sometimes pipe background music into the hallways. This usually consists of the pop tunes the residents or their visiting children had heard in their youth. I'd been visiting a bedbound but alert gentleman named Albert, whose main theme every visit was the lousy and indifferent care he received. He had inspirational messages posted all over the otherwise minimalist room, and various nauseatingly cute drawings, made by volunteers maybe, adorning what space was left. He often gestured to a stack of religious pamphlets fanned out on his bedside table and pressed me to take one. During one visit, as he was reminiscing over his career as a truck driver, we heard Hotel California playing in the background. I myself have taken the lyrics to mean that the hotel guest is in some kind of hell after his life is over, at the hotel where you can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. Albert had another interpretation which captured a hell of a different nature. That guy's like me. I'm never gonna get out of here. Unwittingly, this song only served to remind him of how his disease had imprisoned him and put him at the mercy of these people who don't care. He knew perfectly well that the only exit from his hotel would be via the Grim Reaper, who did not tarry overly long. Aside from such a heart-rending reaction to piped-in music, A more benign problem with it overall is that it can amount to too much of a good thing. The novelty wears off, even for me as a visitor, and it comes to be just another unsolicited sound to block out of consciousness. Moreover, it cuts into the time some people prefer for quiet. Nursing homes are noisy. Beepers go off on residents when they lean too far from their wheelchair and might fall. Residents sound off to themselves or to each other, or to the world at large. Announcements on the paging system blare so loudly I sometimes jump. And oxygen tanks make percussive noises rivaling a rock band drummer that add to the din. Thus, quiet, oh, blessed quiet, is a premium commodity. As with other areas in our lives, we need a balance when it comes to music or other sounds. Part of my job is to judge whether I should sing or not, and if I do, whether the singing should be religious or secular, energizing or soothing. There are many other decisions besides musical ones I have to make on the spot as I observe what patients say and how they say it, and I glean what I can from their tone of contentment, enthusiasm, displeasure, anxiety, impatience, curiosity, or indifference. I also take note of how they move around, what they look like, what their homes look like, and who else is present. On top of that, if this is after the first visit, I think about what took place at the previous visit and how that might guide my plan for offering care. One of the complicated interpersonal dynamics I have to assess is how patients and their families view me. Do they see me as an authority figure ready to levy guilt for their religious failings? Do they see me as a sweet angel they can pour out their soul to without reservations? What ambivalence might they feel about inviting a chaplain over? No matter what they are thinking, part of my task is to minimize anything about me that could inhibit what they need to share with me or their expression of what they would like me to do. Overall, offering my own singing is like bringing homemade cookies or a homemade greeting card. I'm sharing something of myself and making myself vulnerable to their reactions. Will they like the cookies? My voice? Such sharing can dial down a patient's hesitation to share of herself in turn.